What you are experiencing right now is not real. How we perceive moving through time is a coping mechanism our brains have developed to bring the vast stream of information into a singular understanding of temporal continuity. This is referred to as persistence of vision. In this context, we can interpret the early motion studies and cinematic illusions of the 1900s as explorations that provide insight into how our brains construct temporal continuity and the persistence of vision. These works contribute to our understanding of how visual perception and the sequencing of images shape our perception of time, highlighting the role of our cognitive process in perceiving the world around us. The basic theory of scalar expectancy, proposed by psychologist Richard Meyer in the 1960s, suggests that the perceived duration of an event or experience is influenced by the physical scale or magnitude of the environment in which it occurs. According to scalar expectancy theory, our perception of time is not solely based on objective measurements, but is also influenced by subjective factors. How will we use the power of temporal shaping to alter the realities of human culture? Can we slow or speed up the arrow of time? What happens when the steady flow of information suddenly deconstructs? Welcome to episode 7 of The Richest Family, Persistence of Vision, The New Descending Staircase, and Temporal Elasticity, where we discuss stop-motion animation, persistence of vision, and how artists and architects influence and manipulate the perception of time.
The first thing I'm going to say is this disclaimer is not written on this piece of paper. I'm just looking at a random piece of paper
These
with
are not
notes
the
on it.
You're looking for.
Right. But I'm doing this to point out an important point, which is an opinion is like a house of cards built in the house built on the sand. And these opinions are even more so. Leonard Nimoy. Watch out, because our level of conjecture is about to hit. Critical.
Okay. So, Greg, you did a little bit of research when we talk about this persistence of vision idea, and you did a little bit of research on the history of, like, the motion picture.
Yeah, I mean, there were plenty of, like, sort of motion puppets that were these classical toys that had been around since, like, Roman and Greek era, just like a single picture with a string on each side that when you flip it, it's like, oh, you know, baby smiling, baby sad, baby smiling, baby sad. Even the dish with the smiling clown. If you eat all your cereal, the clown magically appears. You know, maybe these are only two frame animations, but they are something that has the potential to change over the course of time. And eventually these developed into zoetropes, which is using this concept that we're talking about, persistence of vision, where if you have a similar image happening less than a second apart, your brain takes a time to adjust, and it's sort of mixing the two images together. So the concept of the zoetrope, either in a disc or cylindrical form, is this thing is spinning around with a series of images, and you're looking at it through a thin slot, which enables you to not see all the images at once, but just a single image over the course of time. So if it's a ball bouncing, a bird jumping, someone walking, you have that continuity of movement.
Interesting.
And this is a concept.
It's a trick of the eye.
Yes.
And it's when essentially the idea of persistence of vision was discovered is what we're seeing.
Well, this, if you look at someone who does like not magic on a stage, but magic, like close-up magic, like pulling, you know, foam balls out of someone's ear and stuff like that, that is very much using this concept of persistence of vision, or the brain's understanding of
so
what it's seeing.
Magicians knew this already,
Yes, yes.
This trick
they exploited it. That's yeah.
Yeah, like they look like there's stuff in the thing in their hand, but they're holding it in the other hand. Then they're going like, look, here it is. And then, whoa.
Yeah.
Because you got the expectation. And this works with other animals. It's not unique to humans. You can do sleight of hand to a gorilla and a dog, and they look at the hand expecting the goodie to be in there. They can be fooled by three-card Monty. You know, right. Three-card Monty is a perfect example. It's like, oh, first I do it slow. You think you know. And then I do it fast and you don't know. Right. You know, so your understanding of your continuity of time is altered by someone else's manipulation of that. You know, even the simple thing, three cards on a bus.
That's an interesting thing because magic and like the technology of magic and manipulating perception, that's why these secrets of like magic were so protected, is because they were a kind of technology. And then as the technology kind of got free, information wants to be free, technologies like zoetrope, as well as others that are based on perception, but specifically in this case a zoetrope, came out of it. Is that kind of what you're
yes here? And at this point it was based on animator's skill, people's ability to visualize, but along came Muybridge.
Before we go to Muybridge, did people sometimes look at this and it didn't work for them, their brains couldn't deal with it?
It's possible. But I've not heard of that, you know, compared to like people who can't see 3D or, you know, these other things that require, you know, some connection that some people don't have. I'm not familiar with that. It's possible. You know, it's possible.
Gotcha.
It's
possible because we're going to talk about this a little bit, hopefully, because there are some brains that like don't do persistence of vision. They're not neurotypical.
Deal with any sort of strobing effect.
Right, right.
You know, instead of it, they're just sitting into it and the effect just going on, their brain is going, wait, and causing a cascade of error and a seizure in many cases.
Let's put a pin in that because I think we're going to get to that when Jim talks, and I want to dig into that a little bit more. But Muybridge is that famous, like, horse running.
Right. The basic bet, so he was into horse gambling and horse racing. And it's strange, like now we think of gambling as just a sort of minor vice, but at one point in time, it was a driving force in society. You know, everyone gambled to some degree, people borrowed money. It was just a thing. So the question was, a racehorse in full gallop, did at any point in its stride, do all four of its feet leave the ground? And everyone's, you know, sitting on the ground and watching these horses with a bunch of dust, and everyone's drunk. And of course, it's a bunch of conjecture that nobody can really agree on. So he sets up this situation where he has a series of cameras with tripwires. So they're not dependent on someone's reflexes to like, you know, like, oh, was I a tenth of a second off? Especially with these old cable powered cameras, you didn't have that level of quickness with stuff. So the cameras were all triggered by a tripwire. And so horse galloped down this a track, setting up a series of like a dozen images. And in fact, the horse, all four of its feet did leave the ground at one time. But with this evidence, who cared about that original bet? This was fucking motion, dude. And all of a sudden people went nuts to see this. And he could film anything. But, you know, someone picking up a bucket of milk, stepping over a chair. And people were freaking out. And it created a whole industry called, you know, what we're now know as the mutoscope. And eventually, at first, they had little flip books, but those are something you would sell to someone, whereas a mutoscope was something you would have in an arcade, and it became another arcade game.
But isn't it?
You know, scientists, we had the entertainment side, but scientists were also looking at this information to this is where the fledgling motion biometrics and all
efficiency,
that
work
efficiency, efficiency and all that came out of the Muybridge experiments, because he was doing people and animals. And
yeah, he's got a grid behind himself.
To this day, animators typically have his book of animal motion and his book of human motion as reference guides, you know?
Yep.
Yeah, so, but ultimately, though, you know, this is about photography. So did they have to develop any kind of special photography or anything like that in order to make this?
Well, you know, this is the turn of the century. So, you know, everything had to be done outside to have sufficient light. And he, you know, created some innovations in the triggering mechanism, you know, that it could be pretty much instantaneous. And he had film that was sensitive enough to create a clear image with such a short exposure. Because if it's all blurry, you're not going to have, you know, concise images, you know, and certainly some of them did look like that, where the motion was too fast, you know, and the film or the exposure was not quick enough to really capture the speed of the movement.
But it was so, but it did become about entertainment after it kind of started photography and then became about entertainment because people were entertained, like, how cute. Whoa, I got, for the first time ever, I've got a movie.
And kind of the nice thing about the mutoscope is that it was a personal experience. You know, you're looking into this device and no one knows what you're looking at. But, you know, okay, so before, even the most proper young ladies could watch a naked guy doing calisthenics.
I want to talk about that, but there's a relationship between the entertainment and just the photography. And Muybridge was the entertainment, but Millais was more... No, Muybridge was the photography, but Millais was like the entertainment part, right? Is that
Originally, he was a stage magician, and his tricks were just incorporated into his stage act. Like, he had these little screens with projectors behind them, and it would be part of... And it required a theater with a very narrow, you know, a hall-like structure. So everyone's point of view was not too divergent. Like, if you sat on the sides, you wouldn't get some of the illusions.
Oh, was he doing Pepper's Ghost in there?
I'm not familiar with that term, but is that something like an old optical printer?
It's a 45-degree mirror so that you can put things behind it and have them.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's a classic magician's trick. Yeah, but no, he's actually filming stuff.
Okay.
And using film projectors. Yeah.
So there's like an iconic thing, like entertainment, and it comes up all the time when we talk about the early movies, which is
Voyage to the Moon.
Okay, and what was that all about?
That's him writing a story that is, you know, loosely based on Jules Verne's First Men on the Moon. And it's about these scientists, and the whole thing is sort of tongue-in-cheek and funny. Like, you see the scientists looking at the moon, and there's some pinup girl sitting on the moon going, "Hey, you sexy scientist, come check me out." And he's like, "Oh, yeah, I'll be right over." You know, forget the scientific objectivity. Look for the hot chicks. That drives science.
So the titillating was something people thought of very, very early.
But yes.
Was the mutoscope before or after Millais? And like, because the difference here is, one, like, the mutoscope, the way I think of it is very kind of democratized. People built machines. They put them in arcades. You can have a private experience with it. You've got a public experience. Someone has to invest in the equipment to make it so people can share that experience. Go ahead, Jim.
Well, because he was already a successful live performer. So when he went and said, "Okay, well, this is here, all my performances just on the screen," people were just like, "Oh, okay. You know, the last thing you did was fun. Let's go see this thing," right? You know, at home, there's just rats and the blank wall, right? So people went to the theater quite a lot.
Okay, so Edison comes in with the magic lantern before the mutoscope. Is that correct? Like, I'm just trying to get a kind of a
timeline.
You know, I'm not sure of the specific timeline, but they're all happening within 10 years of one another.
So basically, sure, somebody came up with the idea. I think that it kind of went like this. Somebody came up with the idea to take something like a zoetrope and then put that onto clear material and put a light through it. And one of them went up on the wall, which is a standard projector or magic lantern. And then the other one went up through an eyepiece, was backlit, and that was the mutoscope.
So Clay, I have a cutaway diagram of both a mutoscope and a, I think they're called a spectroscope. And I think the internal diagram really shows the difference between the two. The mutoscope was basically just like those old Rolodexes with a flipbook on it. And the crank is just making that spin, and there's just a guitar pick making it flick.
So instead of having a piece of film that was laid out with individual cells,
they're
flipping between images like this. Okay.
Yeah, and so after a while, these pieces of paper get worn out.
I think you can see it on the stream. It's coming up now. There's like a disc, and in this case, it's a private box, and you just spin that disc around. And as you're looking through, you're only seeing one image. And you've seen this before in like a flipbook setting, right? I mean, it's essentially a mechanized flipbook.
But the image was pretty dim because it's just the light reflecting off of these paper cards. And maybe it was like a 10 or 15 watt light bulb, you know, because I'm sure if they had anything hotter, they would just create too much heat and the thing would catch on fire. So that means the images, and you really see in these like YouTube videos where people try to like film inside these things, it's very sepia, very dark, whereas the cinematoscope or spectroscope actually had a celluloid with a light projecting behind it. So the image was clearer and brighter.
But people were starting to use this, like once they made it a private experience, like that is the perfect... That's Pornhub.
Okay, so let's talk about what the butler saw. There was a divorce case in England where this man gave syphilis to his wife, and his wife filed for divorce. He countersued and said, well, if I'm promiscuous, she had sex with these men in our house, that she's promiscuous at all. And he said... The butler was the witness to these acts, which he saw through the keyhole. So the entire jury
of the original, that's the original image. And there is a naked, like,
and this was a very sensationalized case in England. It was in the newspaper every day, and the jury had to leave the courtroom, go to the location, and look at people doing things through a keyhole. Once again, we had this intimate viewing experience forced upon the jury for legal purpose. And so they had to look through, and ultimately both the cases were thrown out. You know, there was no actual decision, but this process of the jury looking through the keyhole to see the lurid acts is what the mutoscope was built for. And so they had these films of just a lady going and changing her knickers on her bed. Boom! Millions of people wanted to see this shit. And the machines, instead of being called mutoscopes, were called What the Butler Saw. And eventually they took these French postcards and, you know, now it would become like, man, you're wearing these baggy trousers and changing another pair of baggy trousers. It's so erotic. But they become the main things at these arcade mutoscope facilities. You know, this sort of low-grade porn that didn't exist previously.
Erotica, Greg. Erotica.
Yes. Okay. Yes.
But, I mean, this basically paved the way. Some titties, some tatas.
Yes.
Paved the way for us as a society to incorporate persistence of vision as an entertainment medium in the form of the moving picture, stop right. motion, like using the same concept for stop motion, which like, you know, Clash of the Titans when I was a kid, like giant fan of Clash of the Titans. And Jim, you've been doing some, like specifically on this idea, how we can take things that are actually like sculptural objects and place them in a set of poses in the same way as that horse in this persistence of vision. Would you give a little bit of context for that?
You know, as soon as people started using a camera to take, you know, discrete images to do things like Moy Bridges experiment, to, you know, to check the motion of a horse and whether the legs came off the ground. The other side to it was people saying, hey, I wonder what would happen if I advanced a frame, shot a picture, moved things around, shot another picture, moved things around, and repeat. You know, when we say animation and people bringing things to life through animation, well, animation means to bring things to life. You don't need to say it twice, right? And so, you know, kind of this case study is centered around Ray Harryhausen and Phil Tippett.
But it's you have everything is stopped, and you make it go by taking pictures of it as it goes.
Wait a second. There's another one that Phil Tippett was involved with called Go Motion, gotcha. Which is his big
stop
contribution.
Motion is one kind, and Go Motion is the second kind.
Okay.
What's the difference?
Well, let's go all the way back to its fledgling. I'm sure that there were people that were doing it before George Powell and Ray Harryhausen, but they're probably a good place to start. Now, they worked together on something called the Puppet Tunes. And what they were doing was building a whole set of faces and bodies that were in different poses. And then every frame changing them out. So it's kind of like a shorthand version of this process. But then they kind of started changing this up where they were using armatures that were ball and socket and wire armatures inside of latex models that were painted. And they would move part of it, take a picture, move part of it, take a picture. And this, you know, it's an extremely time-consuming and intricate process because, you know, Ray Harryhausen would do things that had 30 skeletons all animated at the same time on the screen.
Had to have all that scripted.
Had to have it all of it scripted and understand where everything was going and make sure that things were moving when they should and not moving when they shouldn't. This is kind of where we get into what I consider to be the golden age, because, you know, movies like The Mysterious Island and the Sinbad films, Mighty Joe Young. We have like this huge opening.
Jim, a distinction I'd like to make between Ray Harryhausen and George Powell is a lot of Ray Harryhausen's work, especially like these dinosaurs and the Sinbad movies, it's really dependent on his personal animation skill.
Oh, yeah. You know, well, this is the reason why I brought up George Powell is because – Mysterious Island is a George Powell movie. Okay, Ray Harryhausen worked with him.
Well, let me finish my point. Whereas, like, you look at those old Puppetoon things, and you could pretty much create like a dope sheet and have someone else do the animation with the replacement animation. You're just like, you know, face 5 for 10 frames, face 3 for 15 seconds, and you could just give someone a dope sheet. The music come back a week later and they've animated it.
Oh yeah, yeah,
so
yeah.
I think that was a big difference in between the two approaches.
Yeah,
that was just the one.
Basically, what you ended up with is that George Powell was the established guy, and that's
yes, kind of
how he pulled him in. But when you get to something like Mysterious Island, That is pure 100% Ray Harryhausen.
Yeah, that's him pulling 20 hours in the animation room, you know.
Oh, yeah. Like all that crazy stuff. And I consider that to be, I mean, there might be other things that are before that, but that's where I kind of go, this is the groundwork for all of the Sinbad and the Jason and the Argonauts. All of that comes out. Now, Phil Tippett, who, you know, there's not a single green-blooded nerd out there that doesn't understand his contribution to initially the Star Wars films and kind of how...
Didn't he do Starship Troopers also?
Yeah, but that's way, way, way later on. But let's talk about like some of the stuff that he was doing with ILM now.
The animated hologram game that they're playing on the ship.
That's still kind of in the stop motion zone. That is his definite homage to Ray Harryhausen. Now, later on, they start getting into a technique called go motion, because one of the big problems with stop motion, which everybody loves now because it's like, you know, it looks like an effect. So people are like, there's a special effect happening. It's amazing. But it's staccato, right? It has no motion blur between frames to gel it together.
Because generally it's shooting two frames, not one frame. Usually when doing stop motion, that is the standard practice to have enough image for your eye to catch on.
Yeah. So one of the things that they came up with this idea is, what if we took a stop motion animation puppet or armature, and then attached rods to it, for example, and greened them out, and then had somebody do the stop motion animation, but then computer replay using that same kind of stuff that they initially were using for moving spaceships. And even, even going back to 2001 and some of the computerized motion that was used in that film, and apply that to moving rods that move the armatures, right? So then you can shoot it and get motion blur, which is what go motion was, right? Okay. So you can have somebody move the stuff around, computerize that motion, then play it back and film it in a way that you could capture it with the motion blur. And that did not have any of the staccato effect, the jerky effect that standard stop motion had.
Like and I was suppose
when you see the dinosaur's head, you know, like, you know, move around. Didn't Phil Tippett just finish like this masterpiece of his life movie?
His magnum opus, Mad God.
Yeah. It's kind of a descent.
Monsters and dinosaurs.
It's like a Dante's Inferno kind of thing.
It's a Dante's Inferno for the modern world is what it is. Yeah.
I think he had been working on segments of it over the years and then is sort of like editing it together and trying to create the cohesive piece from it.
It's
all beautiful. It's all beautiful.
It's great. Yeah, it's great.
You know, it's interesting. Before you talked about the animation of found objects versus like something you're explicitly making to be animated, you know, like a rubber puppet with an armature. You look at the work of Jans Fankmeyer, who would make these puppets out of like little bird bones and old dolls and stuff.
A lot of claymation
object. He's doing stop motion, but more with found objects and actually having like real people doing stop motion.
Sure.
To integrate it with the, you know, non-living elements. And in my opinion, very successfully.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. There's a whole group of people that were doing it in L.A. What was that called? I want to say it was called Pixelmation or something like that, where you would have a person walking and use them like a stop motion puppet in order to get that staccato feel, you know, because that became like a big deal is, you know, animation was expensive.
Now it's a feature, not a bug.
That's right.
But didn't when we think of like Disney, right? I mean, that's this whole thing too, but in a different way. It's a different technology. It's not like taking pictures It's more like...
Oh, we're talking about cell animation.
Oh, okay, okay. But let me just give a quick intro into like the intro of the theatrical experience. Going into a theater, right? You expect someone to come and go, wow, we're doing this master of ceremonies. You know, that's normal dance hall thing. So let's look at... what's his name? Little Nemo in Slumberland. What's the artist? Windsor McKay. Windsor McKay. Mm-hmm. Amazing, successful cartoonist. Had a daily thing in New York Times for decades. He was one of the first, and in my opinion, very successful cartoon animators. Really set the pace for what we know as cartoons. Did Gertie the Dinosaur. Is him on stage talking to an animated dinosaur. And at one point he says, okay, Gertie, I'm going to come in there and hang out with you. He walks to the side of the stage, and then they had this animated little dude walking up on top of the brontosaurus's back, climbing on, and then walking off into perspective. And you look at the quality and animation of Gertie is anything you would see in Disney, Ubby Works, Fleischer Brothers. And they all sort of looked at that and say, okay, let's dig our heels in and really do this.
Yep.
Interesting.
So to get a little history of what's going on, cell animation was a process whereby a table was set up and you had a stack of transparencies. And the transparencies were sometimes forelit and sometimes backlit. And then they were photographed with a stand camera, right? And so what you would end up with was a group of people who would do these motion studies is the best way I could describe it. The motion studies, like you see the horses, were based on things like Muybridge. So some of the early ideas here were things like, oh, what if we took and traced Muybridge's photographs and then did a illustration version of the cinema, right? And then people like Ub Iwerks and, oh man, the Fleischer Studios, there was like a whole gaggle, another studio that I don't like mentioning because the mice the mice have large ears.
They're already in litigation in Florida right now.
Okay, so they don't have time for me. Basically, these groups of people started producing short films to go into movie houses. In between films, sometimes they even created feature films. But what was interesting was that...
To me, the power of Disney is... I just said it. Okay, I said the D word. Okay.
Oh, no!
But the power of Disney is, to me, that like Henry Ford, the pioneering of Disney was the scaling. The way that they were able to actually factoryize this very complex, very labor-intensive, originally, process, which couldn't scale. They figured out how to scale it so that it could become mass consumed.
And a major factor of that, and I'm going to use him as kind of the case study here, is Ub Iwerks, who was in a lot of ways Disney's first Imagineer. I mean, I think he was. In fact, I think he developed some of the stuff like the president's face is getting projected on. I'm not sure about that, but I know that he designed a lot of animatronic systems because his big contribution to animation was to take this thing that was traditionally a flat investigation of moving forms and automate a stand table, which is a type of camera setup, in order to have multiple planes that you could parallax between. So your foreground, if they were moving towards a castle, the sky wouldn't move at the same rate that the castle, that the foreground. And so you had this kind of differential gear-based projection stand, which dimensionalized the flat animation, right? And so we end up with not only having control. See, this is the big thing about cell animation, is that if you think about it, it is the most flexible methodology for creating discrete time slices that can be anything. You're not limited to what you can photograph. You're only limited to what you are able to draft.
And you have complete control.
You have complete control over it. Well, then iWorks allows you to move dimensionally, either, you know, sideways or going into the frame.
Yeah.
And so
that's when they separate the men from the boys. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, everybody started doing this because he is working during this time for the mouse people. In fact, he drew the first mouse. He's the co-creator of the mouse. Mm-hmm. Right.
He's really a creator of that aesthetic that now we think of as cartoons with the sort of spaghetti arms and legs.
Absolutely.
And you can tell he's just plotting hands and feet, and he's just just makes some spaghetti to connect the two. It's like it's the continuity that matters, not the anatomy.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, he's also the guy that kind of invented a lot of the look that we associate with underground comic books.
Yes. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Hey, you know, Joe, once again. Yeah.
So you have some, like, you've been working in animation pretty much ever since I've known you. So that's a minimum of like 30 years. And so I know I've talked to you about the philosophy. I mean, like, once you deal with a technology like this for so long, there's like things that come up. Or is there anything that comes up for you about like philosophically what persistence of vision kind of is in terms of how we conceive the world or where it's going or anything like that?
So let's talk about that for a second, because the illusion, first of all, it is an illusion, just like an After Effects illusion. And by that, I'm talking about if you look at moving water and then look at a rock, the rock appears to be moving. Right. The reason why we can do persistence of vision is because of the mind's ability to construct imagery from a relatively limited eye. Our eye is essentially seeing about the size of your thumb at your arm's length. Right. And so what we see around us is a constructed panorama. And that panorama is, in fact, a persistence of vision illusion. Things move into your visual and you do not see them the way that you think that you see them. In fact, what you see in your eye is, to start with, upside down. The amount of color is
camera,
limited.
It's camera obscura, essentially.
It's a camera obscura with the ability to rapidly...
It's a mental construct.
Imagine you had a camera obscura where you could see something that big and then your brain just Xeroxed, your eyes moving all over the place and your brain Xeroxing little pixels and little spatterings into place. And then your brain constructs a panorama out of that. That is amazingly stabilized, because that's the other thing that's happening. If you've ever looked through a camera, you know that the camera jitters all over the place, but somehow or another, our eyes are moving around and the image is stabilized.
When I look through a binocular, it moves quite a bit.
It's the brain's need for continuity that sleight of hand magic is based on.
That's right.
Like if I see someone put something in their hand, I'm going to keep looking at their hand thinking like, okay, that's where that thing is. You know, especially if his attention is also doing that thing, because you want to look where the other people are looking, right? You know, you got to assume that we have this herd mentality, that there's a bang and we're all looking left. That's where the bang came from. But there's a scene in Day of the Jackal where these French Secret Service guys want to kidnap somebody and they're in a big crowd of people. So they have two guys start a fight at the end of the block. Everyone on the block looking at the fight. They grab this guy, toss him in the truck. Nobody sees a thing. Busy day, sunny day. And there we go. Misdirection with no electronics, no fancy magic.
Yep.
It's just, hey, look at that. And then do the thing.
Well, that's why the POV works, is because you are being misdirected constantly.
Yes.
Right? And what's happening is your mind is putting together a panorama. This is why, you know, somebody will say, I didn't see that car coming, or that ball came out of nowhere. And literally it did, because the panorama had not been refreshed. Well, what this ends up with is things like the ability to 3D print a bunch of faces and put them into an animation by changing them, you know, one by one, or creating 3D zoetropes.
What we do with modern computer graphics animation is that essentially you render a ton of frames, and you're taking pictures of a virtual scene. And
yeah, morph shapes.
Sure.
Like replacement animation.
Right. So what people have been doing lately is taking the individual scenes out of the 3D and 3D printing them, and then filming that.
The standard practice in replacement animation now is to make the swapped out faces in ZBrush or something, and you're printing it. So you're getting exactly. I mean, George Powell had to sit and carve that shit.
That's right. And so you have like Box Trolls and some of these other films, and they print them with the paint, with some of the paint on them.
Oh, nice.
Right.
Nice.
And the amount of resolution that they're doing. Well, on the flip side to this is that people are going back and revisiting the zoetropes and printing out individual scenes. Like, you would build a scene, and the scene would have like animated characters in it. And you would print out each one of these and put it on a turntable and shoot it with a strobe. And there's a ton of zoetrope. Well, and then there's some other weirder versions. Cosplayers that want to do kind of a Doctor Strange floating spell discs are using something called what's now known as a POV, which is essentially a fan blade with LEDs on it.
Those are great.
And you strobe the LEDs, and it looks like a hologram, right? Yeah,
they make things for that, like for bike wheels.
Bike wheels, right?
Yeah,
they make them for bike wheels.
There's the other, these exact opposite though as well, which is like, let's say you're not trying to enhance POV, you're deconstructing POV, and like there's a whole bunch of art and photography and even people who like spent tons and tons of time in the technology in MIT around taking images and superimposing them onto one scene so that you see all the range of motion in a single image.
Yeah, stroboscopic. Stroboscopic.
Let's talk a little bit about that.
Okay. So basically, what we've been talking about up until now, with the exception of some of Muybridge and some sheets that animators use, is the granularization or the segmentation of time, whereby a slice of time is put onto an individual cell or onto an individual frame of film. And then those are played back in rapid succession, right? Now, the opposite is used in analytics, which is stroboscopic photography, whereby multiple frames or cells of time are encoded onto one piece of film.
Point of view.
That's right. And so a lot of people that are involved with sports medicine use this. People who are doing analytics for industry, even robotics.
Car crashes.
It was also used as an art form, as in people wanted to see kind of mind expanding imagery, and the idea of seeing these kind of streaky, transparent spectral images. Another one is light painting, right, where you would open. I mean, it's similar.
Open the aperture and then draw with the light.
Right, but a lot of times these were I think that it's the same thing. It's just one would use a strobe light in order to expose, and the other one would use just the difference in luminance.
I want to talk a little bit about how this concept that we're talking about, which to me is about deconstructing the temporal, has actually influenced art quite a bit. And before we even had the ability to take these kind of pictures, or right around the time, I mean, 1912, artists really, in my mind, were the pioneers of understanding the essence of the temporal being deconstructed, and started bringing it into their work. And what's really interesting to me is, like Marcel Duchamp did the seminal nude descending staircase, and at the Armory show, it was controversial because some people looked at it and couldn't even understand it. It didn't even make sense to them. But I think in a lot of Marcel Duchamp's work, he was really kind of breaking through the veil.
Yes, that's essentially him. Yes.
Yeah. And what's really interesting is lesser known, but happening at the exact same time, were the futurists
who Giacometti.
Had already embraced dynamism, which is what this really, their idea was, is that, you know, they were like our previous show. They were looking towards the future. They were like, in the future, we will use trains and we'll use...
Well, because they were also involved in theater too, and not just these sort of more static art forms. So I think in a way, yeah, or they, you know, kind of motion and time was a bit more part of their vocabulary. In fact, the guy who made the nude falling down the staircase, Giacometti, who also made that great sculpture of the sort of fragmented figure, had several plays that had no actors. They're just, the curtain would open, yeah, and there would just be sound effects and scenery. You know, it'd just be like, oh, a table with a spilled glass, you hear a gunshot, a scream, then the curtain closes.
Yep. And they were actually doing paintings just like Nude Descending Staircase at the
yes.
exact same time.
Yes.
In fact, like Giacomo Balla did a piece where someone's just walking a dog down, and the legs are in, you see all the sweeping movement of the leash. And all the sweeping movement of the legs, as though it was a stroboscope. And so these people were really understanding this deconstruction and this idea that our brains are assembling these things before we started taking it down the technological track.
And right, to me, like they're seeing the patterns.
Yeah, and this to me is a lot like the magician. Artists and magicians, through time, have had a doorway and a connection to the truths of our human essence. Before the technologists.
But wait a second. There is one fundamental thing that is completely inverted, though, in that the Dadaist and the futurist, Marcel Duchamp being of the Dada school and the futurist, I think what they were attempting to do was the opposite of what stage magic is attempting to do. What they were attempting to do was not occlude things,
yeah,
but
to bring awareness to that process.
To bring awareness to them in the sense that the futurists were attempting to show the multiple exposures in order to capture the feeling that the future of, in their case, and this is a very specific use case of the word fascism, was about speed and momentum, right? They had a very strange fixation on this politics, whereby the Dadaists had a similar thing, but they were hard leftists, right? And so But both of them were attempting to pull the veil off and show what was behind. And the Dadas were, what's behind the veil is absurdity. And the futurist is what's behind the veil? Fast. The future.
Movement.
Well, that's why they all died in the World War I.
They sure did. They sure did. Everybody got...
That's where I think stroboscope really, I mean, like you had a picture of Jean Millet's New Descending Staircase. That was actually an ode and an homage.
It's later. Yeah.
Right. So it was 1949 when that occurred. And so to me, like then a whole bunch of like, once that started happening, the stroboscope and the technology, photographic artists like David Hockney started really, you know, applying this and using the deconstruction of time over the temporal space and compressing it as a subject matter.
Slit scan and all that.
Right. And so that kind of leads me into another whole kind of like thing, which is that we can and do have the ability to manipulate how we perceive time. And this has been a well-known, just like persistence of vision, like these ideas of like rhythms and what we expect to see and is what the magician used, but it's also been used in architectural and artistic forms to manipulate how you perceive reality fundamentally. And so the core concept of this scalar expectancy is that we have kind of a human scale. We are conditioned, and we do that to be able to experience reality at all. We condition our brains to be able to accept that stream and turn it into perception. That exact same thing can be used to manipulate us. And the way it happens on time is with scale. So if you were to be in a room and everything in that room was half size, this is roughly, it's not like you can't, your heart's not going to start beating differently, but you will perceive time differently. It will, if you are in that room, time will move a lot slower in relative to you. In other words, 2 minutes will go by and it'll feel like four. Or 1 minute will go by and it'll feel like two. So you can actually take in more information. And the opposite is true in a highly scaled space. If you're in a space where the columns and the ceiling are way above scale, time goes by slower. In other words, 2 minutes feels like one. So you don't pick up information as fast. And actually, Alton DeLonge did a whole bunch of studies with children and learning around this, where he actually, I mean, these are sociological and learning pedagogical studies, where he put children into rooms that were either small, where all the things were scaled to them, or all the things were scaled to adults. And if it was scaled to them, they actually learned faster because they could actually, their time dilation occurred at a higher rate. They're ticking. It's a relativistic concept, just like the theory of relativity, right?
Interesting.
So that reminds me a ton of like one of my favorite books, Palmer Edrich, the Three Sigma of Palmer Eldritch. It takes my brain into that space where, like in that book, like people on Mars are like, they use drugs and project themselves into dioramas. And time can just grow, and they share that experience. What were you going to say?
I was thinking that I think that was an interesting difference between the mutoscope and the theatrical experience. You know, is that it is scaled to this intimate, you know, keyhole experience. And in a way, the use of the phone as a modern method of film viewing versus like a TV or movie theater, it has kind of become more this intimate experience rather than, you know, space. A social, you know, something you're doing with other people. I'm sorry, Jim, what you're about to say?
Oh, I was just going to say, fun fact, if you're watching David Cronenberg's Existence, when they first go into the game world, The very first thing that you see is a box of cereal in the middle of the table that says Perky Pat.
Well, that's what I used to love about dreams is like you see these made up books and made up series. Like I remember one time when I was in a dream, I passed a comic book rack and they were all these unique comics that I had never seen before. And I was like, oh, if I could only memorize all these, I could draw them when I wake up. And when I woke up, I could get like one or two and it was just fading, you know?
Well, architects have used this as well, just like stage magicians have used it. Architects have used it. And in fact, in modern day, there are a number of really interesting projects that specifically attempt to use this approach. One's the Blur Building. There's this building that is essentially a cloud. The idea of it is that it's just a platform out on the water, but they make it gigantic by actually using, like, they generate a big, have a giant fog machine. And so when you approach it, you feel like your time scale changes because you're approaching something that's gigantic, right?
It's a small world.
Right. And so same thing in future art, which was pretty prominent in right around the year 2000. They did a lot of big projects. They specifically made a public library in Japan called the Sendai Mediatek, which purposefully had these crazy oversized columns and ceiling heights that were non-relational to the person because they wanted people to go in there and stay for hours.
the learning process would be a little slower.
Well, that's the problem, though. I don't.
Yes, right.
Slow down. I don't.
They'll buy more stuff at the gift shop that way.
Well, it was a public project. I thought about that. I researched it. I was like, why did they do this? And I think it's
you look at churches, right? They want giant 20-foot doorways, right?
Churches are the essence of manipulating this scalar expectancy. I don't have any pictures of it because I think it's just so obvious. Putting people into that
Notre Dame
that grand scale is essentially there to just fuck with your space time.
Well, giant statues and giant columns in temples from the beginning of time. There's a reason
you're just some tiny little human.
Exactly. Exactly.
And well, these things are forever. Yeah.
Right. So, like, we got a couple minutes left. Let's talk about, so we've been talking about persistence of vision through all this time, and most of it has been pretty benign, is how to use this to expand the human experience, to expand human consciousness. But what about a certain point where, like, you get a group of people who get it, and they're like, hey, you know, a lot of people don't get this, but they're still spending some money. You know, maybe we could just sort of use these concepts to get interesting products to these people.
Are you talking about subliminal advertising?
Yeah. Vance Packard, The Hidden Persuaders, wrote a book in 1954 about not only hidden freeze frames in film, but also hidden images in animation and even print advertising. That at one point was thought to be nefarious, and nowadays it's just another day of work.
Well, there's a problem with standard. Okay, so if we think about the history of the moving images, early moving images might have been 5 to 10 frames per second.
Right. Film
ultimately became 24 frames per second, where it still kind of is today. Now, video has gone crazy, where it started out as 30 frames or 60 split frames, right? Then it became a standard of 60 frames out there in the fringes, and sometimes 120 to 240. Now, a perceptual weirdness is that it's changing human perception abilities, as in people who watch 60 frames per minute video can actually see subliminal frames in a 30 frames per second video. After that, it's
you
a
get used to
of
that
mind.
Tiny slice of time.
That's right.
Well, I had an interesting thing that previously dogs couldn't understand TV. It was a blinking light to them.
Really? My dogs can see other dogs on TV perfectly.
Well, with the advent of the higher frame rate made all the difference. Then it's a continuous image versus just a scan line. Like, look at video of the old video.
Right.
Well, it looks like garbage. It's just these scan lines. You know,
well, it's not even that.
It's interference.
It's that they actually fields interwove every other line. And so the illusion of the motion was better with the fields, but it actually was because of the way that it was rastering with a electron beam, right? And now everything's CRT.
Yeah. Well, because our brains were able to compensate because of our need for continuity.
Well, that's POV
as
well.
Dogs don't have that quite as much. They were not able to compensate in those more primitive visual technologies.
Yep. So our dogs actually will sit and watch TV and
pigeons or squirrels or other dogs.
We had a problem because a new TV went into the living room because the old TV had some issues, and one of the dogs saw another dog at a dog show and started jumping trying to get at the TV. And I was like, the dog's gonna break the brand new TV. Yeah.
Turn the resolution down.
Hey guys, we have to wrap up. Another great richest family. You know, great topic. And I think we did get to circle back to some of the bigger things that we've all been thinking about when it comes to persistence of vision. So what a blessing, how privileged I am to get to share this time with you guys and share all these cool things.
Good times.
I really love both of you. I'm glad you're both in my life. Okay, we'll do it.
Oh, yeah.
See you next time, guys.
All right, guys. Care, lots Jets. Of fun. See you on the next one.
Bye.
Thanks for joining us for another amazing episode of The Richest Family. We hope that it made you think about weird stuff or at least reconsider something you felt like you already knew. You can watch the video recording of this podcast on YouTube at youtube.com/@ClayTantor. It really helps us grow the channel by liking and subscribing. Or you can watch a stream live on twitch.tv/ClayTantor every other Sunday at 10 a.m. PST. Thanks again, glad you're here, and have a strange and interesting day.